Welcome to Cartoonist Kayfabe. My name is Jim Rugg.
I'm Ed Piskor.
And some business before we dive into Al Columbia, Ed.
Yeah, man. I'm serializing my Red Room comic at patreon.com/EdPiskor, putting new pages out every Tuesday. As of this recording, the first issue is almost like completely available, and $3 gets you the whole archive, man. So hit that up, patreon.com/EdPiskor.
And my Kickstarter for Octobrion in 1976, the world's first Blacklight comic book, is over, and now it's time to pre-order the book. If you missed the Kickstarter, you can get to the pre-orders through the Kickstarter page, or you can pre-order it through your local comic shops. That's Octobrion in 1976. And now, let's get into one of the more interesting cartoonists and artists that I have come across as a reader and as a fan. I'm going to start with just a brief paragraph from the Best of 1999 Comics Journal, which is making more and more appearances. Pretty soon we will have covered every book on this list, I think, Ed. But, you know, I've said it before, this is a very impressionable time for me as a reader. I was looking for something different, and the Comics Journal Best of lists would sort of point me at a bunch of new stuff. And so one of the pieces that stood out to me from, you know, like all the professionals listing stuff, and several people list this one Al Columbia story. I'm going to read this paragraph from Tom Spurgeon, the late comics reporter. And the trumpets they played by Al Columbia in Blab number 10. Despite its short story status, this was the comic I'll remember most from this past calendar year. Al's artwork here is gorgeous to the point where I'm not sure how he gets his effects anymore, how much his computer or how much he paints by hand. And the choice of using the Fleischer Studio characters and general look of those cartoons to depict the apocalypse is an effective one. Al's Armageddon is less an end of now than an end of all time, including our cumulative past and all its cultural dead ends and false starts. It was one of the few wows I experienced all year. Hell, Columbia. So, as I said, several other people list this story, and it's pretty impressive when a short story is pulled by several people for a best of the year list. And so I thought we would actually start a little out of chronological order with this short story because, again, this is how I first come to Al Columbia, and all these years later, it looks better than I remembered it, to be quite frankly. So the trumpets they play, you can see even my copy of this, like the binding has even worn down from being looked at and read so many times. But, you know, I've talked about being raised as a Christian, and so this story is right out of the book of Revelations. This is the Christian end of times story, the apocalypse, the Armageddon. And so that's what you get here, a very faithful adaptation, even with the weird ideas of, like, goats that have multiple eyes. And as you start going through, you know, there are plagues that come down on humanity. There are wars that come down on humanity. All of that stuff is depicted in this comic, very literally, and as Tom Spurgeon describes, using this like Fleischer Brothers kind of iconography and appearances. And I'm old enough that I would watch those cartoons, mm-hmm. You know, like old Popeyes and Supermans were things that I would see as a little kid. And they had this weird darkness about them, you know, especially the black and white stuff. The edges of the screens would be dark. They were very scary to watch those cartoons, and I'm sure you can find them. You know, they're still around. You can probably find them on YouTube, but you look at them, and they're not at all what I think of as, like, brightly colored, cheerful cartoons of today or even of my childhood, like Saturday morning cartoons. They have a real scary world that they're depicting, and so it's perfect for this kind of tone. You see people, like, there's all these little details. Guy juggling knives out his window from a tall building. So what happens when you mess up juggling? Guys, you know, peeing, people shooting rifles, jumping out of windows. This is the end, you know, like it's everything you can imagine bad about humanity. Little baby that shoots himself in the head and we see the aftermath of that. Dark, dark times. This is going to be one of our main characters. So he's watching this all unfold out the windows, along with media coverage of the bad events as well. You're seeing basically an atomic bomb coming. And so he's reading about, you know, how do we survive this, and reading about Revelations and what's happening. And he's kind of, I don't know if he's supposed to be a kid. He has a tail, so I don't know if he's like a monkey pet something sentient enough that he can read and wake up his owner and say, you know, we're in trouble. We got to get out of here. And so he finally wakes him up. We see things like the plagues of locust. Again, if you read Revelations, like, all of this stuff is described in ways that'll make a five-year-old's head spin and give you nightmares. Kind of cool to see Al Columbia drawing from that material, but then also with the cartoony part. You see him jump from his you know, high up in his building window, down into his car, and the car has that springy, rubbery bounce that you'd associate with cartoons. And off they go, leaving again the cartoon iconography of the cloud of dust behind, just the little dust cloud background. And you can see the stuff that Spurgeon's alluding to with some of this background material. Really hard to imagine how you're creating all of these little bricks, the wallpapers. I don't know how much is digital either, you know, still looking at it today. I can remember seeing some originals of his from around this time period, and it was mostly on the original. You know, it was charcoals and ink washes. And kind of surprising, you know, you would look at this and think lots of digital, and then you'd see some originals and see no sign of digital. So I don't know these particular pages, but I know that he used a lot of different media to, you know, to really certainly draw and paint a lot of this stuff on the page. And kind of the money shot, right, of like the end times, the world's breaking apart, chaos is happening, and they're fleeing, you know, trying to flee the scene and get out of there to save themselves, getting away from the city that's engulfed by pretty much the heavens opening up and storms raining down on the people. And in the distance, we see the seven-headed dragon that comes up out of the sea in the book of Revelations. And it's just this horned, nightmarish heads. Incredible, right? Taking over the people as the Armageddon wears on, people start to worship these demons that have come out. And eventually, he is... you know, we see people being executed horribly. Eventually, he is caught whenever he crashes his car, and his little friend pretty much rats him out, gives him up, you know, in an effort to preserve himself. And he's going to be sacrificed with a piece of dynamite, a cartoon bomb, on his head while people are, like, impaled around him and being deheaded and just mass killings all around him.
One of the things, whenever you're watching those cartoons...
One last page. Okay. Once the bomb goes off, we get the vibrant full color. This had a huge impact on me in terms of like, whoa, shit. You can have this kind of page in a story that mostly looks like this.
Yeah. The when you would have the opportunity to see these cartoons, certainly around this time, you're watching it on those cathode ray tube televisions, very smeary picture, the antithesis of high def. So he's even able to get like a fuzzy edge. What the F, you know what I'm saying? It's so thorough in its presentation.
Yeah, that fuzzy edge, that's one of those things, like, I could do that digitally pretty easily, and again, I don't know if he did or not, but it made me think of, like, whenever you would shoot this stuff with, like, a stat camera, or figure out how to shoot this stuff, is that an effect that's happening with the camera?
Right.
Is it something that a really good production person, you know, knows how to do, or knows how to create art that's going to reproduce and look that way? I don't know the answer to that, but maybe we'll talk to Al Columbia one of these days and get some answers. But it's awesome, this ending, because again, if you read the actual book of Revelations, you know, paradise, heaven, is sort of the end of this. After like 1,000 years of whatever, you know, suffering and war and the world being destroyed, then you get your 1,000 years of heaven and, you know, perfection and stuff. So he's very faithful to that book of Revelations. If we were to do an episode on, say, Bible stories or whatever, this would fit perfectly in a story like that. It's a pretty faithful adaptation. Nightmarish, you know, guys having sex with animals and stuff once you realize the end of times are upon us. But a huge, you know, just... This wrecked my brain in every direction. You know, from a production cartooning standpoint, I had never seen anything like this in my life. And it was just like kicking down what I thought was a wall of like what comics could be. This just obliterates it. I often think of comics as like a landscape map. And when you see this new stuff, you see somebody inventing some new language, it's almost like they're fleshing out the map. They're pushing the frontier further and further. For me, this thing just changed the map completely. It was like, throw out the old map. You have a whole nother direction this way that's as rich as anything you think you know. So that made me an Al Columbia fan. And, you know, as I would start looking for alternative comics and indie comics and things, one of the first things that I found from Al Columbia is The Biologic Show. I think this came out of Tundra. You know, he had done big numbers 3 or 4, I can't remember what issue, after Bill Sienkiewicz, and then allegedly that was destroyed and never was published. But I feel like this feels like it would be a Tundra book. And I think he's from New England and was, you know, connected to Tundra, obviously, at that time period. This is like 1994. So shortly after Tundra is over is when this is published by Fantagraphics. And it's beautiful cartooning. It's interesting cartooning. It's a ways off from the trumpets they played that is 1999, so about 5 years into the future. But you still see some of his cartoony investigations, you know, early on here. And I think the black and white stuff is pretty pretty interesting, some of the textures that he is creating too, because that's got to be masked and then, like, you know, a flick of the ink effect for some of this stuff. So he's really kind of going for it. There are screen tones, you know, visible in this stuff. He's doing almost like a negative thing where the drawing is all in black ink with a few white highlights. His ability to draw already, you know, highly on display. Beautiful lettering. A lot of 9-panel grids. A lot of kind of a tight grid approach. And certainly the depiction of a nightmare world. This is issue number 0. Then issue number 1 is 1995. So, you know, assume the next year or whatever. And some interesting layout choices in this one. We see things like this is, you know, 16-panel grid. You're getting to see more of the textures that he is using in the Trumpets They Played story. You're starting to see that. I assume, you know, that's probably charcoal or something that he's getting some stone and brick texture out of. And these characters are Pym and Francie, who we're going to look at in his most recent book after I get done flipping through here. But those characters are characters that he's had around for a long, long time. And used, you know, the sibling team that lives in this nightmare world of, like, two-headed girls and just bad times. The cars reminded me a little bit of, like, a Chris Ware, you know, it's that old-timey feel. Totally different art styles, but kind of a, maybe referencing the same time period as some of Chris Ware's work, which I think is pretty interesting, you know, this being, like, the dark underside of that 20s and 30s time period.
Yeah, you could see just some of the storytelling stuff in the Blab story. Is similar to some of the Jimmy Corrigan stuff.
I thought some of this reminded me a little bit of some of the Chris Ware stuff, like the Quimby the Mouse, you know, almost like an animation style repetition of panels. And then I was trying to figure out how's the timing work? You know, like, when was that released versus when is this released? And, you know, people talk and everybody's looking at the same stuff. 25 panel grid now. It really feels like that animation, you know, almost a cell movement or something, but much heavier with the darkness and stuff. And then I think his face photocopied. Is that how you make a self-portrait if you're Al Columbia there? That's my interpretation. I could be wrong on what we're seeing at that point. He's done, you know, lots of anthology work too, and I didn't dig all that stuff out. He had done a couple of pieces before this, like Godhead and I'm blanking on the other one's name. Again, it's kind of before he really gets to his mature period. But Pym and Francie is the other piece of his that speaks to me the most. And this came out, I think, in 2010, I'm going to say. It was right around the time of Aphrodisiac is part of why I know it. And if you look closely at the cover, you're seeing almost artist edition-like reproduction. You know, you can see pencil lines marking the edges of this. You can see tape, torn pages, you know, smudges along the edges of the page. So that's the first piece that sticks out to me is like, well, that's pretty interesting. You know, it's almost original art that we're looking at rather than some polished finished piece. The story behind this, well, I should say it's Pym and Francie are these brother and sister who live in this animated nightmare world. And I think this is one of the better Dream comics that I've ever read because it has that sense of illogic that dreams have. You know, you see pieces of the world, certain motifs repeat and characters repeat, but there's not a linear natural model the way this flows. But the mythos behind this actual book, I believe, is that he had thrown out all this artwork, and Eric Reynolds, I believe, kind of pieced it back together. You know, they have a long history. I think they may have been in a band together, Eric Reynolds being one of the publishers at Fantagraphics who published this book. But I believe they have a long friendship, and Reynolds kind of went through and was like, you know, don't throw this out. Like, let's put this together. And some of it's torn up, which is interesting with the big numbers history. And some of it's incomplete. You know, it's in this fragmented state, which contributes to me to that dream atmosphere. It's really hard to get that. I think a lot of the dream materials that I see, whether they're in movies, television, or in comics, they don't always capture that feeling. And to me, like my dreams at least, I'll have a couple of details that are kind of in focus, but maybe the setting's not clear,
right?
You know, or I don't see beyond those details. And I think he really captures that. And again, it just gets into this, you know, more ink and kind of nightmarish imagery. And it just goes down this dark, bleak dreamscape, for lack of a better word. You know, like they have grandparents that show up that turn out to be murderers. You have animals that are, you know, showing up in pieces that look like beloved pets or whatever. In some cases, possibly at their hands that these animals are suffering. There aren't easy answers. And then whenever you get to these pieces that are like torn up and reconstructed, it just further adds to that sense of unease and what are we looking at here? You know, at this point, it's almost voyeuristic on mm-hmm. top of everything else. You know, it's a nightmare. It's a dead cat with little cats around it, as if it's the parent has died, and now these babies are left to fend for themselves. And, you know, looking out into that bleak, dark world, it's kind of like those kids take on that baby quality. This is, you know, it's not a traditional comic. It's not, there are panel-to-panel sequences, but it's very much, you know, you can even squint your eyes and read the text that are in these word balloons. So it does create a very unique reading experience. You know, this page looks like a traditional comic, but it's next to or followed by pages that are incomplete, you know, partially formed. Like, did somebody die? Why does this stop here? What happened to the artist? You know, and there's a sense, I think, of the artist as you go through this, especially of like repeating landscapes and locations, specifically the interiors of this house, where it's just like you're in the basement over and over, you know, and there's somebody at the top of the stairs, and it just feels like a repeating dream. But I love all of this kind of stuff, this reproduction, words crossed out, handwritten notes underneath them.
It makes you wonder, like none of this was contrived for the book. This is just Al Columbia's process.
I think so. That's my understanding. He's not a guy with a lot of information out there. There you can find interviews. I've heard some interviews with him, and it seems consistent with those interviews that this is not contrived at all. But I had done Aphrodisiac around this time, which was totally, you know, artificially created to sort of approximate some of the qualities that are in this work, you know, being a found materials and things of that nature. So I don't think that this is any kind of a put-on or affectation or anything. But if you are making work that's kind of meta-narrative, you know, you can certainly learn from this. And again, I think of it within the context of dream comics and history of dream comics. You know, comics are just full of that, going back to the beginning and Winsor McCay. And I think you can comfortably look at this through the lens of dream comics, and that it fits very comfortably on a shelf next to any, you know, any other dream comics from Rick Veitch to Winsor McCay,
right,
and everything in between. You know, it's certainly like a subconscious dumped out onto the page. Let's put it that way. And then what you want to take from that or put on Al Columbia is up to you, the reader. I'm not comfortable saying any of that. I've never met Al Columbia. I don't know. But certainly this feels like you're looking inside somebody's brain, a super talented somebody, you know, that's great as an artist and a drawer and an illustrator and all those things. But it does feel like you're really getting a peek inside of, you know, I hate to say a tormented individual, but man, these are tough. These are dark images, mostly because they are, you know, the main characters are children. So once you add that nightmare layer, it really does get dark. So cool to see like an inked in progress piece. Yeah. So this is one of my most cherished books. Oh man, grandparents coming home to visit them. It's so bleak. It just never ends. You know, it's grandma and grandpa. I know. And you just see the dread in their faces. Like, it reminds me of Pet Sematary or something, like whenever the kid comes back and it's like, oh man, we know this isn't going to go well. It always feels like it's nighttime, you know, and shapes are moving around. And going back to like the Fleischer brothers influence reminds me a little bit of Floyd Gottfredson and some of his figure work on Mickey Mouse, especially like that character. But that hunched over characters, that hunch over is such a sickly posture.
Yeah. We call that the cartoonist posture.
It's very true. It's very true. And, you know, Will Eisner talks about body language with these, you know, with your cartoon characters. The body language that Al Columbia is putting on these is just sickness. It's a real darkness. Great images, man. Shadows coming up the, you know, seen through the doorway. And then that little bit of like yellowing. It's another one of those nice touches. If you're just looking at this as I'm stealing some stuff for my own comics making, that kind of just subtle little bit of color, it's a pretty nice touch, you know, mm-hmm. especially in a work that is predominantly black and white and probably could have been treated as black and white, but having that little bit of extra color. And again, that I think of artist editions with that, you know, you see it with especially older pages that are reproduced in artist editions where you get to see some of the yellows and acids and adhesives and all the little bits that get onto the pages. It's just a great image. So I've only shown you about half of this. I think this book is still available and out there, speaking of kayfabe effect. But this is, for my money, one of my favorite horror comics, one of my favorite art books. I just will never get tired of looking at it. It's really an exceptional piece. And, you know, thanks to Eric Reynolds for rescuing this, if that story is true. And I can't remember where I even heard that story, to be honest. But in my mind, that's the story. So I don't know if it's true or not. But it's when I look at this, that's what I think of.
Yeah, there's a lot of legend around Al Columbia, and these comics are rare morsels, man, so it's definitely cool to put some of this under the microscope.
Yeah, he's a standout in my mind. Like I said, it's part of it is finding him at the right time when I'm looking for a teacher, but also nobody else's comics are like Al Columbia's. Like, he is a very unique voice in the landscape of comics, so I'm excited to get some of his work on the channel for everybody. If you're not familiar with Al Columbia, there is a lot of work out there. It's just in pieces and in anthologies. And, you know, certainly I would say go do a Google search and see what you see, because as a craftsman, he's extraordinary.
All right, kayfabers, like, follow, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Hit the bell. We'll notify you when new vids are available. And the bell mitigates the kayfabe effect, man. This book, it might be $100 now on eBay, and you snooze, you lose, man. So hit the bell. We'll let you know when the vids are out, and you'll be able to make those wise purchasing decisions ahead of the average YouTube watcher.
I always think of the Billy Ireland when I see the cartoon gloves, the classic Mickey Mouse gloves. Be sure and subscribe to the Cartoonist Kayfabe e-newsletter at the link below this video. You can also find Cartoonist Kayfabe merchandise and t-shirts at the links below this video.
One last piece, Jimmy. You got to hit them with the marching orders.
Read more comics.